Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Our newsmaker interview today will be with Congresswoman Susan Davis, who will be talking about a wide range of issues. But first, we have some top local news stories, including allegations that the Descanso Community Water District has covered up critical information, including uranium in the water supply. We'll tell you about a hearing Tuesday on a new plan to open desert areas to energy development and run more high-voltage power lines through East County. Learn about a lawsuit filed against the Grossmont Union High School District that seeks to block spending of bond funds and set money aside to build an Alpine High School. Get details on a hearing that's tonight about the proposed unification of the Alpine and Grossmont districts. Plus, get the latest on a fatal meningitis case at San Diego State University. In our arts and music segment, hear an interview with a representative from the Signet Theater, which had its roots in East County before moving to Old Town. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. The Descanso Community Water District Board is accused of covering up matters that could endanger health and property values, including uranium contamination in the public drinking water. Those allegations and more are raised in an open letter titled Secrecy, the Disease of Corrupt Public Officials. It was sent by the board's vice president, Jeff Rosendahl, and co-signed by the board's former treasurer, an incoming director, and a ratepayer. The letter was sent to District Attorney Bonnie DeMonis, the county grand jury, public health regulators, elected officials, media, and ratepayers. It urges the ratepayers to attend the Water Board's next meeting on Monday, October 27th, which will be held at the Descanso Town Hall. The letter accuses Water Board President Lee Johnson of incompetence and acting unilaterally without informing the board on numerous issues. East County Magazine has asked Johnson for a response, but we have not yet received one. The letter alleges several cover-ups by Johnson, including withholding information on uranium treatment from the board for 4 months, failing to provide all board members with copies of a median household income survey that was done for potential grant funding, withholding a resume from the board for a woman who applied for the district's general manager position, and withholding key correspondence from a ratepayer who had a property dispute with the district. Board members reportedly received copies of the letter only after legal action was threatened. The letter also claims that the current board treasurer, Sherry Minix, acted in a discriminatory manner against a ratepayer who was originally from Europe and speaks with an accent. At a meeting last September, the 30-year-old resident of Descanso spoke critically about the board's president. Minix came to the president's defense, according to the letter, telling the ratepayer, "If you don't like it, why don't you go back where you came from?" In addition, the letter asserts that $1.7 million in repairs are needed in this small-town rural district. The high uranium level in the water has still not been resolved. Plus, a contract bid at $40,000 wound up costing the ratepayers $110,000. According to the letter sent to legal watchdogs and health regulators, the board president, quote, needs to know that following the law and respecting people's rights is what is best for the district, unquote. The water board currently has multiple vacancies, but so far, no volunteers have stepped forward to fill these seats in the troubled Descanso Community Water District. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with an important health alert. San Diego State University is working to notify 300 to 400 students who may have been exposed to bacterial meningitis that left an 18-year-old freshman brain dead. The university issued a press release Friday announcing the death of Sarah Stelzer, but later clarified that she was being kept on life support to donate organs and save the life of others. A 20-year study of patients who received heart or lung transplants from organ donors with bacterial meningitis found that no transmission of the disease occurred. Thus, such transplants are considered safe for the recipients, according to the National Institute of Health. Dr. Greg Lichtenstein, Director of Student Health Services on campus, says people who had close contact with Stelzer recently should contact their medical providers to be treated with antibiotics. This is true even for those who had the meningitis vaccine, which protects only against some strains of the illness. Stelzer had been vaccinated, but the vaccine did not prove effective against the strain she contracted. Those who may be at risk include students who belong to the Kappa Delta sorority, as well as the two fraternities, Alpha Epsilon Pi and Delta Sigma Pi, where the victim attended parties on October 8th and 9th. Bacteria from meningitis can be spread through close contacts such as sharing drinking glasses, eating utensils, cigarettes, pipes, or water bottles, as well as kissing or living in close quarters. Symptoms may include fever, intense headache, lethargy, a stiff neck, or a rash. Persons exposed who develop any of these symptoms are asked not to go to the student health center, but instead to contact a health care provider or go to the emergency room immediately. San Diego State's Vice President of Student Affairs, Eric Rivera, said Sarah was a vibrant young woman who loved San Diego State, her friends, and the time she spent at our university. Health authorities urge college students to get the meningitis vaccine, which does protect against most, though not all, strains of the potentially lethal illness.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education update. Two lawsuits have been filed against the Grossmont Union High School District over its failure to fund construction of an Alpine High School. The suits were filed by the Alpine Union High School District and by a group of Alpine taxpayers. They allege waste and misuse of Propositions H and U bond funds. The Grossmont District has defied a grand jury recommendation to build the high school or to support unification efforts by Alpine parents seeking to separate from the Grossmont District and join the Alpine Union High School District. The County Board of Education has sided with Alpine parents, recommending the unification to the State Board of Education. The lawsuits are asking a court to issue an injunction to prevent further expenditure of Prop H and Prop U bond funds until a decision is rendered by the State Board of Education in the coming months on how the Grossmont District's assets will be allocated with regard to Alpine's proposed unification of the school district. Amid this controversy, a forum on the proposed unification organized by supporters is scheduled for tonight, that's Monday, at 6:30 p.m. at Alpine Elementary School. The lawsuits contend that the Grossmont District has intentionally misallocated millions of dollars of bond funds by redirecting the money from authorized projects, specifically the Alpine High School, to numerous unauthorized projects that weren't specified in either the Prop H or U bonds. Plaintiffs are seeking a halt to unauthorized expenditures and establishment of an escrow account for all the remaining bond funds to be used for construction of the high school, as recommended by the grand jury after its investigation of Grossmont's practices. The lawsuit comes after the Grossmont board majority last month officially indicated it does not intend to comply with the intent of the taxpayers or with the County Office of Education regarding allocation of those bond funds for Alpine's high school. The County Office of Education and its board has recommended to the State Board of Education that Alpine should get its proportionate share of Grossmont's assets, which is estimated to include about $70 million in cash. Because Grossmont is reportedly spending those bond funds at a rate of $200,000 a day, plaintiffs say there won't be enough money left to build the high school unless the court takes action. Sal Casamassima is chairman of the Alpine High School Citizens Committee and a plaintiff in the lawsuit. He says, quote, "It's unfortunate that the Alpine School District and local taxpayers have to incur the expense and effort in filing these lawsuits against the Grossmont High School District, but Grossmont has given us no choice." Citing the grand jury findings that sharply criticized Grossmont actions and the board's refusal to proceed with either construction of the high school or unification efforts, Casamassima concludes, "In the face of such egregious conduct, citizens of Alpine and the Alpine School District seek a divorce from the GUHSD by unifying our district and building our own high school. The district has claimed that enrollment and other triggers to build the school have not been met, but critics contend those triggers have been met and in fact exceeded multiple times. The district has also cited reduced revenues from the state in seeking to justify its repeated refusal to build the long-promised high school. Grossmont has acknowledged it has nearly $90 million in unspent bond funds, and it's awaiting about $20 million more in state matching construction funds. And yet, the district has also announced plans for a new bond issuance of $55 million more in 2015. That adds up to $160 million of current and future bond funds, far in excess of what's needed to build the Alpine High School. Mr. Casamassima says that if the court steps in to protect taxpayer funds slated for the high school, justice would finally be served. He concludes, "We now have real hope that ultimately we will see the day when our unified school district opens the doors to its new Alpine High School."
This is Leon Thompson with an important health alert. San Diego State University is working to notify 300 to 400 students who may have been exposed to bacterial meningitis that left an 18-year-old freshman brain dead. The university issued a press release Friday announcing the death of Sarah Stelzer, but later clarified that she was being kept on life support to donate organs and save the life of others. A 20-year study of patients who received heart or lung transplants from organ donors with bacterial meningitis found that no transmission of the disease occurred. Thus, such transplants are considered safe for the recipients, according to the National Institute of Health. Dr. Greg Lichtenstein, director of student health services on campus, says people who had close contact with Stelzer recently should contact their medical providers to be treated with antibiotics. This is true even for those who had the meningitis vaccine, which protects only against some strains of the illness. Stelzer had been vaccinated, but the vaccine did not prove effective against the strain she contracted. Those who may be at risk include students who belong to the Kappa Delta sorority, as well as the two fraternities, Alpha Epsilon Pi and Delta Sigma Phi, where the victim attended parties on October 8th and 9th. Stelzer also traveled to Moore Park, California, where she's from, to attend homecoming activities there shortly before falling ill. Bacteria from meningitis can be spread through close contacts such as sharing drinking glasses, eating utensils, cigarettes, pipes, or water bottles, as well as kissing or living in close quarters, according to the County Health Services Agency. Symptoms may include fever, intense headache, lethargy, a stiff neck, or a rash. Persons exposed who develop any of these symptoms are asked not to go to the student health center, but instead to contact a health care provider or go to the emergency room immediately. San Diego State's Vice President of Student Affairs, Eric Rivera, said Sarah was a vibrant young woman who loved San Diego State, her friends, and the time she spent at our university. He added, "Our heartfelt thoughts and prayers are with Sarah's friends and family. The university has counseling services available to students suffering from the loss." Countywide, an average of 10 cases of meningitis occur each year. The SDSU student is the sixth person reported with meningitis in San Diego County this year, including a student at Patrick Henry High School who died in February. The disease is spread more easily in crowded conditions such as those in many college living situations, so health authorities urge college students to get the meningitis vaccine, which does protect against most, though not all, strains of the potentially lethal illness. Using caution and avoiding activities that can increase your risk of exposure, such as sharing drinking glasses or eating utensils, are also advised, even for those who have had the meningitis vaccine.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Congresswoman Susan Davis, a Democrat whose 53rd congressional district now represents much of East County as well as San Diego. Congresswoman, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's good to be with you as always.
Congresswoman Davis has a long history of serving her community. She is the past president of the San Diego Unified School Board District Board. She has served as a social worker and as an elected member of the California State Assembly before winning her current seat in Congress. Assignments there include the House Armed Services Committee and the Education and Labor Committee. And now she's running for re-election against Larry Wilsk, a Republican and a Navy SEAL, who we've also invited in a spirit of fairness to also be interviewed, and we're hoping to have him on the show later this week. Congresswoman, let's start by asking you to tell us about what you consider to be your most important accomplishments in Congress and why you believe voters should re-elect you.
Thank you, Miriam. My goal has always been to be an effective bipartisan consensus builder in the Congress, to work with my colleagues to understand how we can develop these consensus around issues. And my focus has really been on the economy, because I know that if we don't expand the economy and everybody feels that they're part of it, then we all lose. My placement on the Armed Services Committee and also on the Education Committee has given me a leadership post.
Right, you're a ranking member on the, is it Armed Services Committee?
On Armed Services, I'm the ranking member of the Personnel Committee. And of course, that committee is charged with taking care of the men and women who serve our country. And there couldn't be more a rewarding and, I think, a consequential position to have than on that committee.
Especially when you represent the San Diego region, which has so many military families and veterans.
Yes, exactly. And when I went to Congress and I had a chance to think about where would I really like to serve, where would I like to put the bulk of my time as a member of Congress, the Armed Services Committee was my choice, and along with the Education and the Workforce Committee, because I see those as two areas in which communities really can't be successful unless they are addressing the concerns of our security, of course. And we do that through our military. And the military plays, of course, a big role in keeping all of us safe and in Homeland Security as well as in San Diego.
Absolutely. Do you have any specific goals if you are reelected for the next term?
I was very influential in bringing the ports of entry changes to San Ysidro so that commerce flows at our border. We know that our economy can be a lot stronger if people do not have to wait long, long hours when they're working in this region. And we have many, many people who take that commute on a daily basis. We know that jobs would be created if we can loosen up that gridlock that we have at the ports of entry as well. So that was a very important accomplishment. And I was able to bring in all of the members of the San Diego delegation to be supportive of that. And we are moving forward. Even now as we speak, the traffic is less mm-hmm. than it was before this was completed. And we're still working on it, and we still have another phase to go, but I will focus on that. The other piece of accomplishment, particularly in terms of the economy and the future of San Diego, has to do with being certain that we fund the National Institute of Health here in the San Diego for the national economy, but also for San Diego. We're very fortunate. We have a tremendous technology and health innovation hub in San Diego.
Right.
And we get, actually, per capita, the greater number of NIH grants that come through at the federal government. And those grants support our young people, they support our scientists, they support our universities, they create this amazing synergy that everybody talks about that really creates jobs here in the region.
Yeah, that is an area where we've seen some differing views among the parties in Congress, where there's been efforts to cut the NIH funding, and I think we're seeing some of the impacts of that perhaps with the Ebola crisis right now. What, in your view, needs to be done to address the Ebola crisis?
I think we actually have to be certain that people who need care get the appropriate care. And when you think about mm-hmm. the fact that we actually have insured so many more people under the Affordable Care Act now, that's a good thing. The right. thought that we would have a pandemic in our country without people feeling confident and feeling that they could go to a doctor, even if they're not sure about what's going on.
Good point.
That's very important. We certainly know that we will have sufficient medical assistance here in the San Diego region. As we speak today, we know that there have been concerns and scares, and there will mm-hmm. be some of those. And I think we have to react as quickly as possible.
What about the research end of it for things like funding research into finding treatments, perhaps cures, and a vaccine?
Well, the most amazing thing is one of the vaccines that's been looked to the most is a San Diego developed vaccine. Mm-hmm. We have our companies, and you know, they start out as small companies. Sometimes
right.
they start out as research at the universities that develop into larger companies. Sometimes they're bought by larger companies, but it really is that innovation hub that has been so supportive of medical science, and we need to keep that going. Without the NIH grants, we are looking at now, within the budget that we hope to pass, $32 billion towards the NIH. It could even be higher, because what we have to be aware of is that other countries are not, you know, staying in one place on,
right.
on this research end. In fact, we know that there are many countries that are moving forward. They have far more help and support and resources from the government. We rely a lot on our local economy, on private business to do that. And that's fine. We want them to do that. We want even some small companies that are kind of niche companies that are looking for cures to more rare diseases to be involved in this. And they are today. But the NIH has really been the backbone, the foundation of how people move forward and develop many, many of these new cures. And I think as a country, we need to be concerned about this. Some of my colleagues, whenever we talk about increasing funding, they want to pay for it out of some other way. But the reality is this is, you know, it's foundational. Mm-hmm. And we should be encouraging basic science. You don't get involved in basic science if you think that it's going to make money. It doesn't make money, point. But it does create the ability for companies and for people to live better. And that's what we should be focused on.
Very good point. Let's talk about education, which has certainly been one of your strong suits as an educator yourself. What are some of the things that you've been working on in Congress to help on the education front? And again, what are some of the things that you think need to be done for the future, both for K through 12 as well as higher education?
I think we need to pass a 21st Century Elementary and Secondary Act bill that prioritizes the ability of our students to be in a system that supports them in the math, in the sciences, in workforce development as they age and move into the higher education system. It's so critical that we have the appropriate instructors, professionals, teachers, principals to provide that key role for young people as they achieve. And so my focus has always been, and partly because of, mostly I think, because of being a school board member and spending so much time in our schools and talking to teachers, every teacher wants to be valued for the role that they play in the classroom. And they want help. They want resources. They want to do better every single day with their students. And we need to make that possible. We need to have a professional accountability in the system that helps that. It's not negative. It's not undermining teachers. It's finding a way to first celebrate them, but more than that, to give them what they need to be successful with their students. And I think that we now have a system in place in a number of our schools that is nurturing in that way. I've always believed that evaluations are good for everybody. They're good for me. They're good for my staff. They're good for everybody in business to have that, but it's a kind of buy-in system where everybody feels that they do better out of the process. Yeah. And that's been important, and that's an issue that I've been fighting for and working for some time now.
Thank you for sharing that. What about higher education and specifically making college more affordable? We've seen student loans and the cost of college just going through the roof and kids coming out in debt for, you know, decades.
Yeah. I often tell the story that when I graduated from Berkeley, I was fortunate enough in those days that it wasn't so difficult to afford a higher education, and especially in our university system, because the state invested in its people. It invested in students. And I knew as a student, and I think my friends knew, that somehow or other, we were not paying our full fare for our education. We knew that the state was contributing. It was contributing three quarters as opposed to today, where it's contributing maybe not even quite a quarter to a student's education. But I also knew that by doing that and by working hard, by playing by the rules, that by getting the education that I felt would help realize my potential, that I would give back someday.
Right.
So and I think that's a feeling that we want all students to have. Today, we actually have several bills that, when passed, would help young people with student loans. Part of it is keeping interest rates low. And the other thing is getting rid of some administrative fees that students and parents pay for taking out a loan, and making sure that when students want to pay down a loan, that the principal is affected, not just the interest rate on those loans.
What is the likelihood, given the current makeup of Congress, that those bills will get through, do you think?
Well, it's tough, and it's tough because we actually had to fight hard to be sure that student interest rates were not raised tremendously and would really have been even more impactful on students. We finally were able to come to some compromise on that, but I don't know why that is resisted as strongly as it is. There is a concern that we have to find ways of paying for that in ways that might actually hurt the students in other ways. So it's important to find a happy medium with that. We also, I think, know that universities and our colleges and actually we have a lot of for-profit schools that need to be looked at, because we shouldn't have universities constantly competing with one another, and that tends to raise rates as well. Nonprofits present a different kind of problem, and they present that particularly for some of our veterans, I think, when there isn't enough transparency in the system for what that student's fees are going for. And because our veterans particularly are paying for their college education from taxpayer-funded dollars, they should be transparent.
Let's talk about veterans and military family issues for a little bit. What are some of the things you've been able to achieve since you've been back there to help military members and their families and our veterans? And what else do you think needs to be done?
The GI Bill obviously was a tremendous accomplishment of the Congress, not the folks who just came in, but for those of us who served at the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Mm-hmm. That is so important, because our veterans and our serving members of the military, men and women, need to know how much we value their service, and that their ability to transition from the military to civilian life is not just critical to them and their family, it's critical to our economy.
Right.
Nothing is worse than having someone who served our country to be on the streets and to not have a job and not have a future. Cool. So that's primary. And I think we've done a good job at that. But I also think that there are many ways we can assist veterans in this transition. Moving from one strong culture to another is not easy. And many, many of our serving members of the military learn that and sometimes don't have the support that they need to be able to make that a smooth transition for them.
And listeners, if you tuned in late, we are speaking with Congresswoman Susan Davis from the 53rd Congressional District today here on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Let's move on and talk about the economy now, including the deficit. You've mentioned that obviously there's always voices saying if we want to fund something new, we've got to figure out how to pay for it. What, in your view, should be done to reduce the deficit and strengthen the economy and also create jobs, particularly here in the San Diego and East County regions?
Creating jobs is very important. And one thing I would say is that it is true that we are concerned when we're looking for the kind of pay-fors that actually hurt our economy.
Right.
I think having a pay-for is a good thing, actually. I mean, we can do that, but we don't want to almost take from Peter to pay Paul in this instance. We really have to be careful where those dollars are coming from. And I'm afraid that what we've seen in the past, particularly when it comes to some of the issues that people, you know, have been concerned about, is that a lot of the money for some very important funding issues may come out of people's health care.
Yeah.
It may come out of serving seniors. So
Social
that's
security,
where
yeah.
that's where the pay for is critical. We should be focused on that. The problem is that we know we funded two wars, we funded a major tax break without paying for things. So when we're told, well, you have to find a pay for that, what is the critical issue that we're trying to address? And how can we look at that and know that there is a way to pay for it? It's just not hurting people in order to help others. And that's where I come in on this, and the kind of balance we have to have. I think that one of the key moves and the key changes that this Congress could make when it comes back for lame duck, but more so in January, and I certainly hope to be part of that, is to pass immigration reform. Numbers show that we would raise our economy, raise wages, and lower the deficit if we pass immigration reform. And there's some really good basic reasons for why that would happen. But generally speaking, we would have people who are engaged in the economy today, but in the shadows, out there.
Yeah.
They would be paying into the Social Security system. They would feel comfortable bringing their best ideas to fruition.
Starting
new businesses. We make it hard on people today, and that would be a tremendous reform. And for those of us, for all of us here in the San Diego region, the changes would be enormous because we have many companies now that manufacture, that are engaged in energy, independent technologies and economies that would flourish. Yeah. If we would make that work for everyone. And I think that part of it is trying to help educate and bring our colleagues here to San Diego and show them what it means to be part of a border region. We can do better here. And we're really at the cutting edge of all this. And so I'm just hopeful that we can move forward with this issue because that will make a difference in our economy.
Yeah. I'm wondering what your views are on Social Security in terms of protecting Social Security versus cutting it, as many of the Republicans in Congress are saying needs to be done.
We need to continue to protect Social Security. We have many, many people who live on the edge. But I think we also can be commonsensical about this, and we can try and develop some new ideas and some old ideas that make some changes that into the future would make a difference. And I think we can do that very well without hurting people that are in the system today. We don't have to touch that. We can look to the future, but we also want to acknowledge Social Security is very, very important. And you can just think about what it would mean to young people if they had to provide greater care for their parents in their later years.
Right.
That's something that I think this country has embraced, and we need to embrace it as well, but we can do it in a way that we can address the issues. We're doing much better, actually, in healthcare and in Medicare because we've done some easy things to try and be sure that we're spending our dollars wisely. Same thing can be done in Social Security.
Now, you voted for the Affordable Care Act. Now that it's being rolled out, I'd like to know how you feel about the way it's working, what's working, if there's things that aren't. Do you see options for improving or changing that in the future?
We can always improve and change on just about anything. I think that's central. But getting started with seeing millions of people who were not insured today, whether they're insured even through Medi-Cal or they're insured through their own exchange system that they engage in, makes a huge difference. And when now that we're facing even possibility, I don't think it's going to happen here, but I think we have to know how to prepare for any kind of pandemic. Having people that are insured makes a real difference. And obviously preparing people for rather extraordinary ways of dealing with those issues. But I think when you talk to people about the Affordable Care Act, they see, you know, there have been problems. Of course, there are going to be some issues and some problems. We have different ways of people engaging with their providers. Perhaps in some cases, there is a professional who they work with on some issues and a physician on another issue. We can do better. I think for women, particularly in women's health issues, but why this is so important is women are the main caregiver in our society.
Yeah.
And they're also the person who's out there being the breadwinner, really, yeah, for their family. Speaking so their health, which is a little more complicated in many ways, is very important. And we want to be sure that women have a place to go for their health care and that some of the ways that the issues, such as even birth control, where for a young person paying a lot of money for birth control can be problematic. It can make a difference of a decision that they make about how they're going to just pay for that. And the fact that we're now trying to move ahead with birth control, but also with some basic tests that people can take to determine whether or not they need to have further tests, whether it's biopsies, whether it's for breast cancer, whatever that may be. A lot of that is now being provided. It's being provided as well for our seniors through the ACA. And there are many, many benefits that people see today. I think it would be very, very difficult for people to now, if someone were to try and repeal that, for them to give that up. Generally, I think it's here to stay. We must do everything we can to find the problems and fix them.
And you've certainly gotten high marks through the years for your votes in support of women's issues from organizations that support women and children, for that matter, also, such as the Fair Pay Act. I'm wondering if you'd like to comment about this divide we seem to see in Congress right now over women's issues, not only reproductive health, I understand you're pro-choice, but also things like the Fair Pay Act, where we're still fighting about whether or not something should be done about the fact that women are still earning 70 cents, 77 cents for every dollar that a man earns.
I was actually in the Education Committee, sitting in the committee, when Lilly Ledbetter came to testify before the committee about what had happened to her over many, many years when she finally learned, because you could not go get that information, that she was being paid so much less than men who had her absolute same job.
Yeah.
And what we see today, we use 70 cents on the dollar. That tends to be for white women who earn 70 cents on the dollar. But for African American women, it's more like 66 cents, I believe. And for Latinas, more like 56 cents on the dollar. And just think about what they could do if they made that full dollar.
Yeah.
What that would mean in their lives if they could put that into childcare, if they could put that into their young person's education, buying more books, buying the kinds of equipment that's needed for kids today almost to just get through school. That would make a difference, because those women would shop at the very stores who are waiting for customers to walk through their doors. That would really help the economy. So when we talk about minimum wage, what we know is that the bulk of people on minimum, I think it's over 30% of minimum wage earners, are all women. Mm-hmm. If we can do better and raise those wages, all wages begin to rise as well. What's happening today, despite a good economy, 55 months of growth in the economy, we still have people who are not earning much more than they were 55 months ago.
Right. Certainly one of the drains on the economy, as you mentioned earlier, is that we've been at war for 10 years in Iraq, and now once again we're back to military conflict because of the ISIS terrorist threat that's occurring and the genocide that's been occurring in Iraq and Syria. I would like to get your views as someone who's on the Armed Services Committee about the U.S. handling of that. Are we doing enough, too much? What are your views about how the military crisis over there should be addressed?
Yeah, it's a tough balance, but I think we obviously have to move forward and do everything we can to, as the president has said, basically to degrade and destroy over time.
So you support the airstrikes?
I support the airstrikes. I also believe that we need to work with our international partners. Mm-hmm. We all probably agree in this country that we don't want to see a full-scale army and military go into another Middle Eastern country, mm-hmm. or anywhere for that matter. But I think people believe that our presence may have even contributed to some of the problems we see today. And I think you could follow that theory out in a number of ways. Mm-hmm. So it's smart to not put a full-scale armies on the ground.
So you would not support boots on the ground?
I think we have boots on the ground, and I think we have to be realistic. I think we need to have help and support. We need to train the people that are going to be on the ground. But we also have to work diplomatically. We have to work across every agency possible to try and impact this issue. We learned that lesson. Finally, we learned it in Iraq for a while. We've learned it in Afghanistan. It's made a difference. Governance matters. And you will never have people who want to fight for their country if they don't believe that their government is going to be there and support them and protect them. Right now, there are not people who live in those areas where ISIS is growing that believe in their own government. So ISIS fills a void for some people, despite the fact that it's a horrible, heinous organization that does terrible, terrible things.
There's also a humanitarian crisis here. Million and a half people have been displaced because of ISIS. Here in East County, we have a lot of Chaldeans and a lot of Kurds, other people from the Middle East, who've been trying to get Congress to support raising the caps on immigration from that part of the world to allow at least the persecuted minorities, the Christians, the Yazidis, some of these groups, some of them to be able to come here. Congress adjourned without taking action on that, but I'd like to know what your views are on that.
Congress adjourned without taking action on that and dealing with the authorization of use of military force.
ISIS, big one.
I actually believe that Congress got out too early. I think that there were issues that we should have dealt with. We should have stayed, mm-hmm. and we should have made sure that those issues were addressed before we left. But I think leadership wanted to move people out, and I think that was a real mistake that we will regret. However, I do think that when it comes to the Chaldean community and when it comes to making certain that we're listening to the fears of the community here in San Diego and in other places, we need to move forward. I'm supportive of lifting that cap. I think that it really behooves us as a moral nation to be doing what we can to help people out. I personally have enjoyed working with the Chaldean community. We actually have followed up on some meetings so that there's a better coordination and law enforcement here. I think law enforcement was certainly reaching out, but there are some really good ways to do that. And I think the community is engaged in that as well because we want people to feel safe. I think that they actually were uncomfortable with some of the what was happening and fearful as a community here. We really want to be sure that they know that they're safe.
Yeah, that's interesting. The El Cajon mayor, I know, said that if they can come here to tell them that they will be safe. That was what he said to a group of 2,000 or so Iraqi Chaldeans that were rallying for this in El Cajon.
Yes, no, it's very important. They're part of our community, and there's no reason in the world that they should feel targeted.
Yeah.
And we have to be sure that that doesn't happen.
I'd like to circle back to the economy and energy issues for just a little bit. I think it's very important with all of the things that are happening right now to ask your views about climate change and what needs to be done about that and what kind of energy policies that you support.
Well, I'm very pleased to see the city of San Diego, and I know the cities surrounding that are looking at what they can do and what their role is. And some of those goals that they've put forward are pretty ambitious. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody would say that we're not seeing climate change, although there are quite a few of my colleagues who actually are kind of deniers in this area. But I think we are facing differences in climate that are new to everyone. And some of that translates into some pretty horrific storms and
drought and wildfires,
disasters, really, weather disasters, that impact on families and mm-hmm. certainly on their security and obviously their income. So I think that we need to address that. People are doing that in many different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people are doing it with solar, whether it's on their home or they're buying into some of the solar systems.
Yeah, I wonder what your thoughts are that exist. Say industrial scale solar or wind versus solar or other energy sources in the urban areas closer to where the power is used.
There are upsides and downsides for all of that. I think nothing is perfect. Nothing is going to be 100%. Mm-hmm. There's something to be said for solar farms, although there are some impacts for that. But on the other hand, the cost of people individually having solar apparatus on their roof, they may actually do better by buying into, you know, more of the solar industry in different ways. I mean, that, and I think people just have to look at that. It's individual. Some of us, I just want to have solar panels because we think we're helping out mm-hmm. and we really want to have our footprint be smaller. But we know that there are also issues about how energy rates are developed, and there's some change now coming about to try and look at that. And I think that San Diego Gas and Electric, I know, is engaged in that process. And
yes.
I've had a chance to meet with them and discuss that. And I think we all need to just educate ourselves about what is the best for our family. How can we move forward? What can we do to make a change? Do we want an electric car? You know, is that a good investment mm-hmm. For us? Because all of this adds up. But everybody, most people do frequent stores, grocery establishments, work in a business. And so I think every one of those establishments plays a role. And we need to speak out, you know, let our voice be heard. If we see that things aren't being recycled, you know, go ask, you know, can we do better? So we all have to be part of that. And I think that's partly what the city plans are all about as well.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about yourself or your campaign or your work in Congress?
I view my work in Congress as a way to help people. I started out in my professional career as a social worker. And this is, for me, it's an extension of that. Also, being a mom, being a military spouse, our office works with many, many people across a broad spectrum of issues. We get about 1,000 pieces of mail a week.
Wow.
But over the course of a year, annually, we solve, of the 1,000 key cases, you know, higher cases that we deal with, mm-hmm. we solve about 80% of those to the full benefit of the constituent.
That's a pretty impressive casework record.
We do that with the great work of staff in the office. It's case management. It's tedious sometimes. You have to be persistent. You have to go nag. You have to do all kinds of things. And I play a role with that as well. I was really pleased to meet at the recent Oktoberfest in La Mesa a gentleman who we were able to keep in his home. So it was not foreclosed. Wow. And the only way he was able to realize that was because the work that was done in my office. Happened to be a call that I had been involved in as well, but most of that came through the office. And when you meet someone like that and you feel that you changed their life, there also was another woman there who we helped actually make sense with one of her healthcare providers so that she could get a surgery that was badly needed, but that they were kind of pushing her off.
Wow.
So call us. That's what we're there for. We're there for our constituents. I always will be. To me, that's the best part of this job.
Very good. Can we just end by having you let folks know with reapportionment where your district is now, what communities it includes, Susan?
Well, the communities of East County that it includes primarily, if we move from Sierra Mesa, the Allied Gardens area, Del Cerro, and parts of the what I call Patrick Henry, Jackson, into San Carlos. We're part of San Carlos. It includes La Mesa and the western half of El Cajon, the Helix area. And then we actually are part of the south, too. So if you almost think of, you know, the top of a seven going all the way through to El Cajon and then coming down into the South County area. So Otay Ranch and Bonita and the eastern portion of Chula Vista, in addition to the mid-city of San Diego, including Balboa Park.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Congresswoman, on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you. Good to be with you. Thanks.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight. I'm your host, David Cotty. My guest today is Sean Murray, Artistic Director of Signet Theater in Old Town. Signet began its life actually in La Mesa, or Rolando to be proper, in what is now the Moxie Theater space. Signet is currently presenting in rotating repertory two plays by Sam Shepard, True West and Fool for Love. Sean, how did the Shep rep, as you've called it, the staging of these two plays, come about?
We've been doing reps in our season now for the past 2 years. We've been doing a number of plays that perform alternating nights. Last year we did The Importance of Being Earnest and Travesties, two plays by two different playwrights that had at least a thematic link between the two of them. Very different plays. One was a little more dependent on the other one. This year we decided to focus on one playwright. And Sam Shepard is a playwright that I've always been pretty interested in. And so when we were looking for a rep that we could do, there are certain requirements that those plays are going to have since they have to perform on alternating evenings, and that's that the cast be able to do both plays, be right for both plays, and that you can accommodate the technical requirements for both plays. And so in looking through the Shep rep options, the two plays that seemed like they really went together would be True West and Fool for Love. Because they both have the same number of actors, they were written pretty close to each other. So in terms of where it lies in his career, these two plays sort of kind of go together in a way. Even though they couldn't be more different, they also both are exploring some of the same themes.
Let's talk about the two plays, beginning with True West. What makes this compelling drama?
The thing about the Shepherd plays that I discovered in doing these plays is that he's really working on a kind of real deep primal level, that there are a lot of layers to these plays. There's the story, then there's the story under the story, then there's the theme under that theme, and then he actually talks about themes that are way down in the bottom. And he's talking about Cain and Abel, the break from man's break from nature, really visceral, primal things going on. As it percolates up to the two brothers in the play, you get the dichotomy of these two different brothers who are from the same upbringing, who on the appearance at the top of the show are very different. But as the play progresses, you realize that they are actually of the same cloth, of the same DNA, actually. And so there's something very powerful in watching these two halves of a whole fight it out. The intellectual versus the visceral, the artistic versus the non-artistic.
As I understand it, Fool for Love is by far the less produced of the two. You said it's a tricky play. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, Fool for Love appears to be a story about a passionate pair of lovers who've been separated, who've had a lot of ups and downs, and Eddie the cowboy is trying to get his girl back, and there's a love triangle. All of this stuff is sort of the surface plot of the story. As you dig down into the play and you're working on it in rehearsal, first of all, you realize none of these characters are ever telling the truth. You don't know who to believe. They actually tell you, characters turn around and say, she's lying, he's lying. You don't know who's lying. You really don't know what the truth is. We don't have Mr. Shepherd sitting in the room to say, well, yes, that's a lie, that's not a lie. So you have to sort of discover these things through the rehearsal process and decide what you think is real and what's not. That was an interesting process, trying to decipher what's really happening. But the thing is, there's a plot development that by revealing it might take away from the experience of seeing it, so I'm not going to share that. But there's a development that becomes extremely strange and unnerving, and the real source of what's going on between these two people. Both of them are heavily dependent on each other. Both of them can't really be together. One character is trying to break away from the other and establish herself as a new person, and the other person is trying to drag her back into being who she was. So there's this sort of identity crisis that's going on. There's a lot of layers of it.
Sean, you wrote in the program for the two shows that Sam Shepard sees us as a people clutching to an American dream that has already failed. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, he became really interested in the history of the Native American people and began to feel that essentially Western European people came to this continent and through theft and murder and all sorts of other methods took over this continent. And that their relationship with the land of this continent is one of money, capitalism, ways to take advantage of the land. And that sort of disconnect between human beings and the earth they live on is something that he feels is at the core of the problem with America, is that Americans deep down know that in their history, they essentially stole this continent. And that America has a promise, but the promise has been filtered through a sort of Caucasian lens, and that really until man can reconnect with the spirit of the earth, the spirit of the land, the spirit of the continent, they're never going to be settled. And he equates that with the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, that there's a disassociation with nature that will always keep us as a restless people. There's a lot of very deep stuff that he gets into with this kind of thing, and I think it is the core, very deep core of a lot of what this play is about, is this sense of having to reconnect with a broken genealogy. He feels that there's a sort of unspoken promise, or maybe even spoken promise, that America is going to fulfill everybody's dreams. And his plays focus on those people who are a bit left behind with that dream. They inhabit motels, trailer parks, they're disaffected cowboys, rock stars, pop goddesses, waitresses. The people that he talks about are all people who are on the fringes of society, and they don't understand what is it that's fueling their anxiety.
Tell me briefly about the challenges of presenting two plays and repertory in terms of logistics and in terms of getting people to come to both.
First is that each play has a very different technical requirement, a different set. The lighting, everything is different for both plays. They're completely standalone plays. So you have to basically tech two full productions. But True West has some technical requirements where they basically essentially completely destroy a kitchen every night. Just destroy it. And so that means that kitchen has to be restored, and usually has to be restored within a certain amount of time, because the next show in about 2 hours will be Fool for Love. And that is not only a kitchen, but it's a clean space. And so there's logistics of just that alone. One of the wonderful aspects of doing these two shows in rep is that both plays are completely standalone. They were not intended to be performed in rep. So an audience could really choose to go to one or the other and not worry about, I'm missing out on something because I didn't see the other. I feel that once you see the one, you're going to be very curious about the other, because they're both came out of the heart and brain of one of America's iconic playwrights. I think the real theater lover is going to want to see both, because they're not done very often, and it's a chance to really dive into some Sam Shepard.
So that's True West and Fool for Love, presented at the Signet Theater's Theater in Old Town, which is right there in the heart of Old Town. Before we go, tell us about what's coming up at Signet in 2015.
Well, we're presenting a new original musical version of A Christmas Carol in December. We've done for 8 years now, 1940s radio-style Christmas presentation. We have packed up the radio, moved it aside, and this year we're moving forward with it's a production of A Christmas Carol that's all new music. It's made with puppets. It's a family show. It's going to be a pretty delightful Christmas holiday piece. After that, in January, we're doing the premiere of The Sons of the Prophet by Stephen Karam, which is a pretty fascinating, funny black comedy about a family, a Lebanese-American family in Pittsburgh, trying to deal with a lot of family tragedy. And believe it or not, it's a comedy. But it is about sort of how pain in life is sort of part of life, and you have to embrace the hard in order to love the good. And it's a pretty beautiful play. We're going to be doing My Fair Lady in the spring. Our production of My Fair Lady is pretty unique in that we do it with only 10 actors. It's a very much a chamber version of My Fair Lady, and so it's a way of getting to hear it and see it like you've pretty much not seen it before. And then following that is The Whale, which is a just amazing play by Samuel Hunter, an alienated young teenage daughter and her father, and it's about, he's about a 600-pound man who lives in the house. He's a shut-in. And it's about how this man will pretty much do anything to get his daughter to open up her heart and move on. It's truly about unconditional love. Pretty intense spectrum of characters in that play, and all of them just really very alive and human.
Sounds like a fascinating season, as always, at Signet. Thank you very much, Sean Murray, Artistic Director of Signet Theater.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.